Let me begin with a story. Not long ago, at an altitude of 39,000 feet over Omaha, I was chatting with a fellow passenger when she asked, "By the way, what kind of work do you do?" "I'm a writer," I told her. "I write nonfiction books for children." She looked at me quizzically, as Alice must have looked at the Mad Hatter, and said, "Nonfiction books for children? What a strange way to make a living." She was absolutely right. To be strange, the Oxford English Dictionary assures us, is to excite wonder or astonishment, as in, "Many strange and wonderful sights were seen this present year in the sky." Strange implies wonderful, and it is truly wonderful to celebrate the strangeness of my craft at this gathering tonight. I'm grateful to the members of this year's Newbery Committee for honoring my book and for recognizing that a work of nonfiction can be worthy of this award. When I learned of their decision, I was thrilled, and I was astonished, as I am sure were many others who didn't expect the nonfiction book to win a Newbery Medal. The last time it happened was in 1956, 32 years ago. Of the 67 Newbery winners to date, only six, including my own book, have been nonfiction. Strangely, the book that launched these awards in 1922 was a work of nonfiction, The Story of Mankind by Hendrik Van Loon. I still have my own boyhood copy, a special school edition that I read when I was 10 or 11 years old. I remember where I read it, curled up on the maroon Chesterfield that dominated our San Francisco living room. I spent several foggy summer days on that sofa, absorbed in The Story of Mankind. The title is revealing. It was a history book, to be sure, unmistakably a book of nonfiction. Yet I read it that summer, not to fulfill an assignment or write a report, but because I wanted to. I read it for pleasure, for the thrill of discovery. I think it was the first book that gave me a sense of history as a living thing, and it kept me turning the pages as though I were reading a gripping novel. It wasn't just like a story. It was a story. Since The Story of Mankind, every nonfiction winner of the Newbery Medal has been a biography, the story of a life. Invincible Louisa by Cornelia Meggs in 1934, Daniel Boone by James Doherty in 1940, Amos Fortune, Free Man by Elizabeth Yeats in 1951, Carry On, Mr. Bowditch by Jean Lee Latham in 1956, and this year, my own Lincoln. Along with the medal winners, there have been a number of nonfiction honor books through the years, including two previous biographies of Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's World by Genevieve Foster in 1945, and Abraham Lincoln, Friend of the People by Clara Ingram Judson in 1951. And, of course, Abraham Lincoln by Ingrid and Edgar Dallaire was a Caldecott Medal winner in 1940 and remains a favorite today. So it seems that if you want to win a prize, Lincoln is a good subject. And yet the fact remains that until recently, nonfiction books received a disproportionately small and meager share of the awards and prizes designed to honor the best literary work for children. While nonfiction has never been completely ignored, for a long time it was brushed off and pushed aside, as though factual books were socially inferior to the upper crust stuff we call literature. Upstairs, imaginative fiction dwelled grandly in the house of literature. Downstairs, hard-working, utilitarian nonfiction lived prosaically in the servants' quarters. If a nonfiction book were talented and ambitious enough, it could rise above its station. But for the most part, children's nonfiction was kept in its place. Milton Meltzer, who has written many fine nonfiction books for children, discussed this state of affairs 12 years ago, in February 1976, in his influential Hornbook article titled, Where Do All the Prizes Go? The Case for Nonfiction. Librarians, teachers, reviewers, he wrote, the three groups who usually administer the awards or serve as judges, seem confident that only fiction can be considered literature. Meltzer's article was widely discussed, and it caused waves. The year it appeared, for example, a new category, nonfiction, was added to the Boston Globe Hornbook Awards. Why is it that factual books for children have had to struggle for the right to be taken seriously as literature? Surely there have been works of nonfiction during the past 32 years that were worthy of a Newbery Medal. Certainly no acceptable definition of literature can be so narrow as to exclude books based on fact. Good writing comes in many guises. Isaac Walton's Complete Angler, a book about fishing, has been recognized as a literary classic for over 300 years. Emerson and Thoreau, founding fathers of American literature, were primarily writers of nonfiction. Out of Africa, The Diary of Anne Frank, Silent Spring, they're all powerful works of nonfiction. John McPhee has been highly praised for his adult nonfiction. He calls serious nonfiction the literature of fact, which is the title of a writing course he has given at Princeton. Like others, McPhee emphasizes the fundamental role of the nonfiction writer as a storyteller who takes an oath to tell the truth. Whatever you're writing, he says, your motive is always to tell a good story while you're sitting around the cave, in front of the fire, before going out to club another mastodon. We keep finding new ways of doing this. My father was a great storyteller. The problem was we never knew for sure whether the stories he told were fiction or nonfiction. He was also a dedicated bookman. In fact, my parents met in the bookshop. She was a sales clerk, and he was a sales representative for Macmillan. They held their first conversation over a stack of bestsellers, and before they knew it, they were married. I had the good fortune to grow up in a house filled with books and book talk. As a young man, I worked as a journalist and later a television publicity writer before discovering my true vocation. One day, I happened to read a newspaper article about a 16-year-old boy who was blind. He had invented a Braille typewriter. That seemed remarkable. But as I read on, I learned something even more amazing. The Braille system itself, as used today all over the world, was invented by another 16-year-old boy who was blind, Louis Braille. That newspaper article inspired my first book, a collection of biographies called Teenagers Who Made History. I hadn't expected to become a writer of nonfiction books for children, but there I was. I had wandered into the field by chance, and I felt right at home. I couldn't wait to get started on my next book. As Sid Fleischman said in his acceptance speech last year, it was as if I had found myself, and I didn't even know I had been lost. That was during the early 60s. Since then, children's nonfiction has changed significantly in form and content. Consider biography. Until recently, children's biographies tended to be heavily fictionalized, dressed up with imaginary scenes and manufactured dialogue, as in Drink Your Tea, Eleanor, said Franklin. There's an old tradition for this. In the United States, fictionalized biography has been a publishing staple ever since the Reverend Mason Locke Weems made up the cherry tree anecdote and inserted it into his Life of George Washington. The fifth edition of Weems' biography appeared in 1806. There we find the earliest known version of Little George's immortal confession, "Father, I cannot tell a lie." The whimsies of Parson Weems influenced generations of biographers. Fictionalization was justified on the grounds that it made history palatable to young readers, that it heightened interest and helped clarify complex issues. Along with fictionalization, children's biographies were characterized by a reverential tone, reflecting the educational values of the time. The purpose of biography was to bring the good news, to paint a life that was exemplary. Controversy and criticism were avoided. Important historical figures were portrayed as idealized stereotypes. Schools and school books presented a sanitized, sugar-coated version of history. For example, in the Dallaire's Caldecott-winning account of Lincoln's life, there is no mention that Lincoln was assassinated. As the book ends, the president sits down in his rocking chair to enjoy a well-earned rest. Children's biographies have come a long way from the old days. That was inevitable, given the social and educational trends of the 60s and 70s that affected all forms of children's literature in so many different ways. The hero worship of the past has given way to a more realistic approach, which recognizes the warts and weaknesses that humanize the great. And fictionalization has become a naughty word. Many current biographies for children adhere as closely to documented evidence as any scholarly work, and the best of them manage to do so without becoming tedious or abstract or any less exciting than the most imaginative fictionalization. Today's youngsters seem to prefer the facts. Isn't it more encouraging for a young reader to know that others, even the great figures of history, have shared the doubts and fears a child feels, then to be confronted with a paragon? Jean Fritz has done more than anyone to change the ground rules of children's biography. "Children don't need a perfect picture," she says. "They need to see what human nature is, that history is made of the same stuff as our lives." I grew up during the cherry tree era of children's biography. Recently, I looked again at a Lincoln biography I read as a boy. It contains my favorite example of invented dialogue. Abe is 11 years old in this scene, and his father is bawling him out. I quote, "Books," said his father, "always books. What is all this studying going to do for you? What do you think you are going to be?" "Why," said Abe, "I'm going to be president." I read that book as an elementary school student in San Francisco. Apparently, the lessons of Lincoln's virtues were lost on me, for I was always being summoned to the principal's office. From the school corridor, I would enter a small waiting room, and from there, a door with a frosted glass pane led into Mrs. Kepi's inner sanctum. I would sit on the wooden bench in that waiting room, waiting for the ghostly form of Mrs. Kepi to appear behind the frosted glass as she rose to open the door and say, "Come in, Russell." On the waiting room wall hung a pendulum clock, tick, tick, ticking off the seconds as I waited. And looking down at me from an adjacent wall was the bearded visage of Abraham Lincoln. George Washington may have been the father of our country, but Lincoln was the one who always knew when I was in trouble. His picture reminded me that in America, a boy could travel from a log cabin to the White House, or rather, a good boy could. And from what I had read, young Abe was definitely a good boy. He was never late to school, and he always kept his clothes clean. As a young man working in a general store, he was so honest that he walked, or maybe ran, miles through drifting snow to return 2 cents change to a forgetful customer. Honest Abe, always fair in games and work, always kind to man and beast. That's the Lincoln I grew up with, a first cousin to Goody Two-Shoes, It's worth noting that the history of Goody Two-Shoes was published by John Newbery in 1765. If there was a man behind the Lincoln myth, I knew little about him. It wasn't until years later that a passing remark in a piece by Mary McCarthy ignited my interest in Lincoln. Mary McCarthy, hardly a sentimentalist, said that she was fascinated by Lincoln's intellect and melancholy. Melancholy? That was my first inkling that a complex and paradoxical man, a believable human being, was concealed behind the layers of historical makeup. After that, Lincoln intrigued me, and when Clarion Book suggested that I write a presidential biography, Lincoln was my first and immediate choice. One of the great joys of writing nonfiction for youngsters is the opportunity to explore almost any subject that excites your interest. I picked Lincoln as a subject because I felt I could offer a fresh perspective for today's generation of young readers. But mostly I picked him because I wanted to satisfy my own itch to know. Approaching a biography of Lincoln is daunting. There have been more books written about him than any other American. Thousands of titles covering every imaginable aspect of his life and career. Luckily, a friend told me about the Abraham Lincoln Bookshop in Chicago, so I made a beeline to that shop. I introduced myself to Daniel Weinberg, the proprietor, and told him what I was planning to do. Dan Weinberg saved me. He helped me chart my course through the Lincoln literature and decide which books to focus on. If it weren't for him, I'd probably still be researching Lincoln. My book wouldn't be finished today. Along with my reading, I had a chance to enjoy the pleasures of eyewitness research. I visited Lincoln's log cabin birthplace in Kentucky, his boyhood home in Indiana, and the reconstructed village of New Salem, Illinois, where he lived as a young man. I went to Springfield, with its wealth of Lincoln historical sites, and to Washington, D.C., for a first-hand look at Ford's Theater and the rooming house across the street where the assassinated president died. There's something magic about being able to lay your eyes on the real thing, something you can't get from your reading alone. As I sat at my desk in New York City and described Lincoln's arrival in New Salem at the age of 22, I could picture the scene in my mind's eye because I had walked down those same dusty lanes where cattle still graze behind split-rail fences and geese flap about underfoot. When I wrote about Lincoln's morning walk from his house to his law office in downtown Springfield, I knew the route because I had walked it myself. I'll never forget my visit to the Illinois State Historical Library in Springfield. One afternoon, while I was working there, Tom Schwartz, the curator of the Lincoln Collection, came over and asked, "How would you like to see the vault?" I followed him through narrow aisles past crammed library shelves to an impressive bank vault. He twirled the big combination lock, swung open the heavy door, and invited me to step inside. It was cool and still in there, with temperature and humidity precisely regulated. Tom began to show me original documents written in Lincoln's own hand, a letter to his wife, a draft of a speech, scraps of paper with doodles and notes scrawled during long-ago trials in country courthouses. Each document had been treated with a special preservative that removed all traces of acid from the paper. Tom Schwartz pointed to one of Lincoln's courtroom notes and told me, "This will last 1,000 years." I didn't actually learn anything new in that vault or see anything that wasn't available in facsimile. And yet, looking at those original documents, I could feel Lincoln's presence as never before. Almost as though he had reached out to shake hands. The more I learned about him, the more I came to appreciate his subtleties and complexities. The man himself turned out to be vastly more interesting than the myth. Of course, I was never able to understand him completely. I doubt if it's possible to understand anyone fully, and Lincoln was harder to figure out than most people, the most secretive, reticent, shut-mouthed man that ever lived, according to his law partner, William Herndon, who knew him as well as anyone. That's something I wanted to get across to my readers, a sense of the mysteries of personality, the fascinating inconsistencies of character. I was never tempted to write an idealized, hero-worshipping account. A knowledge of Lincoln's weaknesses throws his strengths and his greatness into sharper relief. And it certainly wasn't necessary to embellish the events of his life with imaginary scenes and dialogue. Lincoln didn't need a speechwriter in his own time, and he doesn't need one now. One of the beauties of his speeches was their eloquent brevity. He agonized over his speeches, revising and cutting and polishing until the moment he mounted the podium. He couldn't stand folks who were long-winded. Referring to one such person, Lincoln said, "That man can compress the most words in the fewest ideas of anyone I ever knew." He loved to tell the story about the lazy preacher who was notorious for his long-winded sermons. When asked how so lazy a man could write such long sermons, one of his deacons replied, "Oh, he gets to writing and is too lazy to stop." I tried to keep that in mind as I was writing this speech. I've been asked, "How long did it take to write your Lincoln biography?" Well, Lincoln was my 34th book, so let's say it took 33 books to write it. And it took the help and support of a great many people. It took the help of Vernon Ives, an original founder of Holiday House, who gave me the encouragement I needed to finish my first book, and who published that book in 1961. And the help of Marjorie Jones, my first editor at Holiday House, who treated me gently while I was struggling to learn my craft. I've been associated with Holiday House for so long that I'm indebted to just about everyone there. To Barbara Walsh, the managing editor, and David Rogers, the art director, to John and Kate Briggs, who have made me part of their family, and to Marjorie Kyler, an inspired editor and dear friend who has never stopped pushing and prodding me to do better. I'm grateful to Anne Troy, my editor at Clarion Books, who put her magic touch on Lincoln, as I knew she would, to Carol Goldenberg and Sylvia Fresolini, who designed the book and thereby graced it, to Marjorie Naughton, whose enthusiasm and skill helped make this evening happen, and to Jim Giblin, a staunch friend and ally long before he became my publisher. Lincoln said, "The better part of one's life consists in his friendships." The children's book field has given me some truly wonderful friends, and this is a perfect moment to thank them all. Finally, I want to thank each of you in the American Library Association. You're the people who set the standards for children's books and put those books into the hands of readers. As you know, Lincoln valued books and librarians. Speaking before the Springfield Library Association on February 22, 1860, he said, "Writing, the art of communicating thoughts to the mind through the eye, is the great invention of the world, enabling us to converse with the dead, the absent, and the unborn at all distances of time and space." The poet John Keats once said, "A life of any worth is a continual allegory." Maybe that's why I started with a book of biographical sketches and, after some byways, was drawn back to biography, to Lincoln. Perhaps, after all, it is that sense of worth, that allegorical illumination, that both fiction and nonfiction are after. And I take your support to be the recognition of that secret yearning in all of us.